Now, before we talk about developing self-worth in children, those of you that have a syllabus, I just want to call your attention back under the tab of basic principles. The first section is called Developing a Unique Design. And at the back of that section, there are questions here for you as a parent to evaluate the way you talk to and treat and address your children. And if your answers are no down some of these areas, you in all probability are contributing to a poor sense of self-worth in their own lives. In other words, do I speak my child's name with pleasure? Johnny! You know, Johnny dear, I'm telling John Thomas, you know, and go through their whole name. And do I frequently yell at my child when it's bedtime, etc.? Do I establish eye contact with my child when I talk to him? Or do you holler from the other room and they never hear you? You keep hollering and then finally you're sure that they're disobeying you. And you're going to be amazed that most of the time they honestly never heard you. Even though you hollered five times and plenty loud, then all of a sudden you show up in the room. I love talking to teenagers about this because I like to ask them, you know, how way out or how freaked out do you think your parents really are? That here they're in their own world, they haven't heard a word that has been said while mom or dad have been building up their anxiety. And then out of nowhere, they walk into the room, I have told you for the last time. You know, and they look up at this adult. What in the world is wrong with him or her? I mean, just out of nowhere, they're acting like a freak. And now they do know that you're mad. And through all of this, they're trying to figure out, is this the look that means she really means it? Or have I seen her look worse than this? So you don't have to be too afraid of this look. And so we do all kinds of things and you know what we end up doing? I've called you for the fifth time, you've been disobeying me, and they honestly didn't hear you, and now you're calling them a liar, aren't you? Don't tell me you didn't hear me. I've said it plenty loud. The neighbors heard me. And they didn't hear you. Are your husbands, ladies, able to look right into your eyes while you're talking and not hear a word you're saying? Well, I want you to know something. Our kids can do it, especially when we're in the other room and talking, and we think, well, hey, since we're the authority figure, they ought to stop whatever's going on, and they should have heard me if they didn't. And they didn't. Well, you can go down and read through this. Then there's another page here for you to evaluate your child and your child's behavior and their disposition and whether they're really beginning to develop a real lack of self-confidence and self-worth in their lives. And then there's a poem here that one of the famous Christian poets of Brazil wrote and dedicated and wrote about the girl with the scar. It's really quite an interesting poem. So those are just some other things that are right there in your syllabus. Now, let's talk about developing self-worth in children. I think one of my greatest joys in raising my children has been to start out with the knowledge that every one of them are different. God has made every one of them different. He does not want me making them all be like the other one. There is such a temptation in us as parents. Your brother got A's in history. Why don't you get A's in history? Or your sister did this and thus. And we start wanting them all to be just like the other one. And we fail to recognize that God made every one of them different. He says, train up the child in his way. Figure out the way God is molding him and then encourage him to develop in those areas. I know one rebellious man. He's a rebellious man today because mom had one goal in life for her son, and that was he was to be a doctor. And the vocational guidance people in the high school tried to tell her, this boy is not mathematically minded. He has skills with his hands. He loved to work on cars. He was mechanical. And mom would not accept that. She forced him to college. He flunked out of college. The fights ensued. He got involved with another gal and with a gal and so forth, and his whole life just is a mess. Now, one of the most helpful things to me in beginning to understand how uniquely God has made each of my children has been to understand their spiritual gift. Now, at the advanced seminar this summer, we'll get into the whole area of spiritual gifts, and there just isn't time in the basic to deal with it, and it's a very important area. But just knowing, it started out with me recognizing how different God made my wife and how he gifted her. My wife's gift is showing mercy. And the most important thing to my wife is how people feel and that people are getting along and that there's an atmosphere of love in this environment. Now, I only have one child who is gifted with the same gift I have. My youngest one also has the gift of showing mercy. There's also reasons why we react to other people's gifts. I'm convinced that most of the rejection that takes place in a marriage is not a mate's rejection of something their mate is doing wrong, but our frustration with God that he made our mate the way he made her or him. Because when I ask myself about the things that used to upset me about Carol, and I would ask, now, is what she's doing sinful? The answer was no. Is what she's doing wrong? The answer was no, but I didn't like her doing it that way. And when I would come home, and honey, what'd you do all day today? She said, I just sat here on the floor and played with Sharon. I said, well, how long did you play with Sharon? Well, I don't know, 3 or 4 hours. You sat on the floor for 3 or 4 hours and played with a baby? Honey, why didn't you give her a toy and go get your work done? And you know what? In her heart, the priority of her life was the emotional well-being of that child. Guess why God didn't make me the mother? I'd have this kid that knows how to tear toys apart and would be an emotional wreck. There wasn't anything wrong with what she was doing because it's the way God made her. My son, I used to have real struggles with my boy. Number one, he's left-handed, and I couldn't wait till my boy grew up so I could teach him everything. And here he is, left-handed. He was slow at learning how to play sports. When my girls, all three of my girls were 2 years old, they could dribble a basketball and not lose control of it. When David was 6 and I'd roll a ball slow to him, he'd get down after it went through his legs. He literally would. It wasn't until he was 9 years old and started playing soccer that his coordination started to develop. And one of the things that really bothered me about David is that David would seem to cry over anything. But not when he got hurt. If he hurt himself physically, you couldn't get a cry out of him. If you spanked him, you had a terrible time getting him to even go, huh. I mean, once he fell off the porch, and he had this big black eye here. 2 days later, he falls down the steps, and he's got a big knot in his head. Then he falls again. He's got another bruise on his face. And you know, he didn't cry once. But his sister could look at him crooked or cross-eyed or go, oh, like that, and this kid's a basket case. And I am really getting frustrated. And I'm trying to get this, to stop this. You know, and it seemed like he'd cry over nothing. I said, Dave, what are you crying for? I don't know. Well, stop your crying. He said, I'm trying, Dad. Well, stop. Look, you got to be a man. Now, just stop it. And I am really, you know, because I traveled quite a bit, I'm really seriously getting worried that this guy, you know, he is just around too many women. I mean, he's got his mother, his three sisters, 2 female gerbils, and 2 female cats. And this is just kind of a little override here, and this kid of mine is going to grow up being a wimp. And I'm really concerned about this, and I try to say, no, look, let's just talk about it. We can work this thing out. And he'd try to shut off the tears. And boy, it was really frustrating to me. until I discovered his spiritual gift. My son's spiritual gift is teaching. His greatest joy in life is learning about something. If he doesn't understand something, he gets frustrated and it brings him to a brink of tears. And even as a grown man, you can see him when he gets into a situation of frustration that he begins to almost panic a little bit. And the first time I caught this, he was in third grade, and I realized that his gift was teaching. And he came home from school one day, and he had these 25 problems to do, and he was just learning to subtract from zeros. And he brought this one problem over to me, and I checked it, and it was right. And he says, okay, Dad. And so he went and did the other 24 problems, and he brings them back, wants me to check them. And I look at him, and all 24 are wrong. And I said, Dave, I said, these are wrong. Huh, Dad? No, they're not. By the way, once a teacher figures out a way to do something, it's almost impossible to change their mind. Number one, they are so thorough in what they do that they believe most people aren't very smart anyway. You know, teachers walk in, by the way, Larry, you know, you just spoke on that site. By the way, have you read so-and-so's book on this subject? No. You read so-and-so's book and so-and-so? No, they've just read about 40 books. I'm trying to get through two. And so then they wonder, how in the world can he get up and talk on a subject when he hasn't read all the books on the subject? And that's the way they think. I remember in college, I could pick out every teacher with the gift of teaching. This guy walk in, first day of class. Well, I just want to pass out the bibliography here. Now, there's only 102 books. Now, I don't expect you to read all of them, but it'd be good if you just went to the library and browsed all of them. I never went to the library and browsed 100 books for a course. But the teachers in the class, those with the gift of teaching, couldn't wait to get to the library, read all those books, go through the shelves and find books that they hoped the teacher didn't even know were there. And then when they find out that Dr. So-and-so knew that that book was there and that book was there and that book was there, this guy is one of the most brilliant men you'll ever meet. And so those teachers never liked people like me. You know which students they liked? The ones they bumped into in the library. The only time I ever bumped into them in the library is when I wanted to read the sports page in the newspaper. And I would go to these people that read all these books, and I'd say, hey, by the way, when does the guy really get into the thing? I mean, you know, most books is kind of a rehash of everything. Well, his real point is chapter 4, thanks. And I go read chapter 4. So I try to tell David that this is wrong, and he is sure he's right. And he says, no, they're not, Dad. I says, David, all your answers are wrong. And he starts to cry, Dad, they're not wrong. I said, David, they're wrong. Dad, they're not. I said, but I realize, here's the frustration. I says, now, come on, David, stop your crying. Look, if we just take 30 minutes, we can sit down, we can figure this whole thing. I don't want to take 30 minutes to figure it out. Okay, if we hurry, we can do it in 10 minutes. All right. So I get me a sheet of paper, and I make me a big number with lots of zeros, and I start to subtract, and I get to the third zero, and he's got it. Oh, now I know, Dad. Okay, I can do it all by myself. No, come on, Dave, let's just finish this one problem, Dave. No, Dad, I can do it all by myself. I said, no, Dave, come on, just this one problem. You mean, Dad, I can do it all right, you know, and I feel all this rejection. He goes and does the 24 problems perfect. And you know what he did? There was a sample problem at the top of the page, and it had a 7 and an 8 underneath the two zeros. It was like 100 minus 78. And the first problem that he was to work had a 7 and an 8 under the two zeros. Maybe it was 200 minus 178. I don't know what it was anymore. And he assumed, which of course would give you a 2 and a what, 2? For your answer. He assumed that every time there were two zeros, the answer was 2, 2. That's logical, right? It's backwards. And as soon as he got that, and you know, every time I sensed my son starting to panic or start to cry over nothing, as it appeared to me, I realized he was frustrated and I needed to invest the time with him and give him the information. He was such a small kid that in fifth grade he was the shortest boy in the class, and Cheryl in the sixth grade was the tallest person in the sixth grade class. And we've got pictures of fifth grade David with his head not coming up to Cheryl's armpit. And the guy should have had a terrible inferiority complex with a big sister like that, but he didn't. And he really got to where he honestly could accept himself the way God made him. Now, my second daughter, she's a ruler. Loves to tell everybody else how to do it. Loves to get everybody else to do it. Now, we're alike. In fact, and you know what? We laugh at each other now. She was home from college at Christmas time. She's sitting watching the television, and she is at least 10 feet closer to the television than I am. And a moth starts flying around in front of the television. And my daughter turns to me and says, "Dad, would you go and kill the moth?" Here's this ruler. The ruler's not going to do it. They're going to get somebody to do it. And I said, "Me? You're closer. You go do it." Now we're really kidding. We're not mad at each other. But you know that we've got a battle of the minds here. And that we're going to have a little tough time as to who's going to end up doing this. Mother is standing behind me ironing. And she's sensing that the level of tension in the atmosphere is rising. And while we're going at it, telling each other to do it, what happened? Mother went and got the fly swatter off the fridge and killed the dumb thing. Now, would you two just be quiet? Trying to get this atmosphere calmed down. My littlest one, Karen, when she was 4, we had company. And she went around at bedtime and kissed everybody goodnight and went down to bed. About 3 minutes later, she comes walking upstairs and she says, "Dad, can I ask you a question?" And we would always go alone into a different place. And so we went into another room. She says, "You know, I just want to ask you a question. I just wanted to know if when I kissed Mr. Miller goodnight, if you thought that I didn't like you." And I said, "Oh, no, Karen." I says, "I'm glad you kissed Mr. Miller goodnight. I said, if you had only kissed Mr. Miller goodnight and not kissed me goodnight, then I would think you didn't like me." "Well, Dad, I would never do that." What was she worried about? She went to bed worrying whether she hurt my feelings as a 4-year-old. And just knowing that her gift was showing mercy, I understood why she was so concerned, because I'll tell you what, there's a real temptation on the brothers and sisters to say, "Oh, Karen, you're always worrying about how everybody feels." Karen was always the one that would come home on the bus and tell us who all the kids were that weren't being nice to each other. Or which ones didn't like her. Well, did they say something? No, but I could just tell. And you know what? Comforters are excellent at reading people's eyes. So are prophets. Now, first of all, recognize that God has equipped our children with a unique appearance, unique abilities, their own spiritual gifts. And then purpose as a parent to cooperate with God in the development of those inward qualities in each child's life. And help your child have a sane estimate of their abilities. That's what the Apostle Paul says in Romans 12. Have a sane estimate of your abilities. Know what your limitations are. When we have that sane estimate, our real struggle should be a conceited attitude. But you know, that's not the major problem with most Christians. Most Christians have an inferiority complex. They really don't believe very much in themselves. They really don't have much confidence in God's wisdom and the way he made us and the way he equipped us. And really, when we have a proper sense of values about ourselves, the thing we should be struggling with is that we don't think of ourselves more highly than we ought to think. Now, what I did all through the years is I tried to to configure in my mind what the unique qualities were of my children, what those strengths were. And the way I did it was to draw out of my children what their interests were. And I started asking my oldest, when she was about 5 or 6 years old, I started asking her, and then subsequently I asked the rest of my kids, what she would like to be or what she would like to do when she grew up. So I'm just going to illustrate my oldest one here tonight, because I talked a little bit here about the other ones, more along the line of their spiritual gift. Well, the first thing I ever asked Sharon, I said, Sharon, what would you like to be when you grow up? And without giving it a thought, she said, I'd like to be a ballet dancer. Well, that kind of took me back because, ballet dancing wasn't what I really had in mind for my daughter's life. Now, the scripture doesn't say thou shalt not ballet dance, but I didn't really, wasn't too excited about that. But forgetting what the real vocation is, what are some of the qualities of a ballet dancer? Graceful? Disciplined? Beauty? What else? Artistic? Pardon? Attention? Physical stamina and ability? All right. Leadership? Pardon? Unique? Individualistic? And if we took a little more time to give some more thought about this, or we did a little research about a ballet dancer and so forth, we would start to really understand some inner strengths. Now, people with those same abilities identify with someone with those characteristics. There are some characteristics in that ballet dancer, and I didn't even know she'd ever seen one, that she could identify with. She also took her first airplane ride when she was 5 or 6 years old, and she gets off the plane, and Dad, when I get bigger, I want to be a stewardess. Now, anytime we could figure out some of those qualities, we would try to develop a family project that would give the child an opportunity to express this. See if they really did like it. Well, this one was a natural because we had company coming over that night. And so I said to Sharon, how would you like to be a stewardess tonight when this couple comes over? And she got all like, okay. So I played a little dumb, and I said, well, I don't know what a stewardess does. I mean, what if you're going to be a stewardess, what do you have to do? Dad, if you're going to be a stewardess, the first thing you have to do is give them napkins. So I lined this thing up just the way she explained it. Then what do we have to do? Then you have to give them something to drink. Because back then, if a child flew, they had to fly first class, and so she got the royal treatment. So we set this up for the company to come. When they came, we seated them in the living room, and Sharon went around and passed out napkins to everybody. Now, they didn't know what was going on, and we didn't tell them. Then she went and poured the punch, her and Mom, and she comes in on the tray shaking, and we're praying, and we just had this new beige carpeting, and she gets it all delivered to everybody, and later goes back and collects the glasses. Then at mealtime, she's getting up with Mom and helping clear the table and so forth. We still never said anything. When the company left that night, who did they congratulate? Sharon. They were so amazed at this little five-year-old that when they went to leave, they bent over and they said, Sharon, you have been a wonderful little hostess tonight. Thank you so much. What did that do to her sense of worth? Now, the next thing she wanted to do is she wanted to go up and down the street selling things to people. But she didn't want to charge them anything. Now, what's that? Poor business. Okay. Gift of giving. Generosity. And so, now the Lord created this one. We had a snowstorm 2 days later, and we had elderly people living next door, and Sharon didn't have school, and I said, Sharon, let's you and me go out and shovel Mr. Klinke's walk and his driveway. You do the walk, and I'll do the driveways. So we worked a good part of the afternoon. About 5 o'clock, he comes home, comes up to me to thank me, and I said, don't thank me, and I made it So that Sharon did the entire walk. I never helped her with his front walk. And I said, Sharon worked in your walk and did the whole walk all by herself. And so he walks over to her and he reaches in his pocket to give her some money. And he's trying to give her money and she's embarrassed and she says, no, I don't want any money. And she's standing there, you know, I really don't want any money. And I'm seeing the embarrassment. And so I called him and I said, honestly, Mr. Klinke, I said, she doesn't want any money. I said, so don't give it to her. I'll take it though. Then on another occasion, she wanted to be the person that worked in a grocery store. She didn't want to own the store. She wanted to be the person to put all the things in the shelves. What quality is that? Organization. Now, one day, I was laying in the bed, and Carol called in and said, honey, would you mind folding Sharon's sweater on the bed? And I said, sure. So I had my own way of folding, and I started to fold it, and Sharon says, Dad, that's not the way you fold a sweater. You want me to show you how? So she was 5 or 6 at the time, and I says, okay, show me. So she started, and then she couldn't remember, so she went to the drawer and opened the drawer and got out another sweater, opened it up and looked at it, folded it back up and put it in the drawer. I mean, I would have at least left it there so I could have copied. Then she came and she folded the sweater perfect. And then she says, there, that's how you do it. And this blue one goes under the white one. Now, like I said before, my wife has a place for everything and everything in its place. One lady came over once to get some things from church out of Sharon's drawer. And here was everything perfect in the drawer. I've only been able, after 30 years of marriage, to hang on to one drawer. It's all I got left. And it's just like college days. It's all in there somewhere, and I know I can find it. Now, do you know who I've just described to you? I have just described to you my 26-year-old daughter. Her junior year in high school, I took her to Columbia with me in May, and they invited her to come back to Columbia for the summer to work because she was in secretarial school at the big public high school in Kansas City, and came in first out of 167 secretarial students in the big citywide competition. She goes down there. The first project they gave her, these four missionaries, well, they invited her back for the summer, and just before, the day before she left, we're running around picking up stuff, and she says, Dad, I got one question I want to ask you. I mean, how much money are they going to pay me for doing this? And I turned to her, I said, Sharon, I'm not going to pay you anything. She says, oh, praise the Lord. She says, that's the only thing I've been worrying about, Dad. I do not want any money. And so she went down there. She spent the summer, 10 weeks. One of her projects was to take their four libraries and catalog them and get them all organized, and she had that done in 2 weeks. The last 2 days when she left, she typed 77 letters. And she's very highly organized, very self-disciplined. You want to guess what her gift is? Serving. Her gift is serving. She loves to please people. If she believes in you, there isn't anything she wouldn't do for you. But my daughter was also what I called nonverbal. She has a nonverbal gift. In other words, she doesn't think it's necessary to be running at the mouth all the time. She thinks the only time you ought to talk is when you have something important to say. Now, I'm a talker. Did you ever guess that? And I can't understand how you could be in a room with somebody and you wouldn't talk. I mean, what are you doing there? And I would come in the house, and Sharon would be alone in the house, and I'd say, hi, Sharon. Hi. What are you doing? Studying? What are you studying? History. What are you studying in history? The Renaissance. What do you find interesting about the Renaissance? Dad, do you have to ask so many questions? She really felt I was nosy, right? What was I trying to do? I was trying to get her to talk. And when I found out, that's not the way you get a server to talk. If you want to get a server to talk, you need to do something with them, because servers like to do things. And they only like to talk about things that are important. But a server is locked into your sincerity. They read a person whether they're sincere. If they're sincere, there isn't anything they wouldn't do for them. If you're insincere, there isn't anything they will do for you, because they love to please you. And when I figured that out, I started coming home, and I would say, hey, Sharon, you want to go play tennis? Right now? Right now. All right. She'd run, get her tennis clothes on. We'd drive to the tennis court. Wouldn't be one word exchanged between us. We'd play two games of tennis. The next thing you know, she'd start to talk. Why did she start talking after we'd played a couple of games? Because by that time, she'd figured out that I didn't do this because I had to. Because if I only did it for that, I was insincere, right? She knew I was busy, and she knew I really cared. And while we have the time together, there are some important things she really would like to talk about. And she would start talking, and we would talk all the way through the three sets. She would be talking all the way home. And after we had talked out what was important to her, she didn't have a whole lot more to say. She was happy. She liked to be alone. She likes to be alone. She loves to read. She loves to write letters. And if you don't understand her gift, you'll worry whether that person ought to be alone, whether there's a problem, and there isn't any problem. She went off to West Germany for 2 years. She was a secretary to 10 missionaries. Lived in the hospitality house with an older German couple, and everybody that came through, they did all the entertaining, and she loved it. And it's so exciting when we, as parents, commit ourselves to cooperating with God in the unique way that He really has made our children. And it's fun. I still do it. I coach ball. I'm always involved with teenagers, and I am constantly, when I'm around them, I just try to look at them and see if I can't figure out some of the neat things that God sees in them. Now, by the time they're teenagers, if they have a sense of low self-worth, you'll pick up some of their individuality by what they complain about. Now, why aren't people friendly? Why don't people do such and such? And you'll be hearing what they're frustrated about, which really is what? It's a concern of theirs. I have a Sunday school class of about 165 adults, and my goal is to help every single one of them in the class discover what the burden and the vision is that God has placed in their hearts. And since a lot of them don't know what that individuality is in their life, they are expressing their calling of God in the form of a complaint or a gripe or a criticism. I mean, why doesn't somebody putty those windows? And that person assumes everybody else ought to know this. Everybody else should have seen this. And you know, I find that the only one God showed that to was them. You know what would happen if everybody in the church would tithe their time to God? There's 168 hours in a week. That'd be 16.8 hours. And let's say you come to three services a week, and we'll even include that in the 16.8 hours, which would take up about 10 hours of your time. And that means that if you and I would give 7 hours a week to the Lord. How many adults do you have in this church, Tom? Okay, 200. What would happen to this church if everybody just did their little part, because God says all of us are to do the work of the ministry, and it isn't all verbal, and it isn't, because a lot of it is in the form of service and ministering to others. 200 adults, each given 7 hours a week, that's 1,400 manpower hours. What would happen to this church? Now, let's just be realistic and say that, you know, that never would happen. Let's just go with 10%. 140 manpower hours a week put in here by the people. You'd have a tough time finding a place for everybody. And we're not going to get out and get involved in what God is concerned about, which is reaching out and touching other people's lives, reaching people's lives, if we don't get a real good handle on this area of our life. One of the greatest things to help us with our own, if you have children or you're involved in other people's lives, start committing yourself to discovering the unique way God's made them and encourage them to develop those characteristics. And it really will be a real joy to you. Great thing for you to do is your children may aspire to certain characteristics in other people's lives that you don't have. So have them read biographies. Expose them to Christian leaders who have their act together. Expose them to people that they can look up to and admire.